I enjoy a nice glass of wine, but I don't pretend to be an expert in wine. I usually just want a wine that's high quality, delicious, and not too expensive. And to me, that's Bogle Family Vineyards. And here's the thing about Bogle. This is a third generation family-owned winery from California that makes exceptional wines for about 10 bucks a bottle. Bogle wines consistently earn Best Buy designations and high ratings from wine enthusiasts. And let me tell you something. The folks at Wine Enthusiast, they drink a lot of wine. They drink a lot of fancy, expensive wine. And yet they still keep giving great ratings to Bogle. And Bogle Vineyards has so many different kinds of wine. Whatever your mood, whatever you're eating, there's a wine for you. They got this great Pinot Grigio that's crisp and fruity, goes well with spicy foods, with fish. They have a classic Chardonnay that's balanced, amazing with a pork tenderloin or butter chicken. I like to take that Chardonnay and do what Jacques Pepin taught me, a couple of ice cubes in your glass of Bogle. If Jacques Pepin says it's okay, then it's okay. And there's the Bogle Pinot Noir, refined and elegant with bright fruit and about as food-friendly as a red wine can be. You're not going to believe it's only $10. Neither will your friends if you tell them. So pick up a few bottles of Bogle wherever you buy your favorite wines. Please drink responsibly. So, tell me about your relationship with pork growing up.
Ooh, did you just ask a Muslim what their relationship to pork is?
I did.
Wow. Wow, Dan, stay woke.
This is The Sporkful. It's not for foodies, it's for eaters. I'm Dan Pashman. Each week on our show, we obsess about food to learn more about people. I think it's fair to say that most of us grew up with rules or customs around food, right? Things you aren't supposed to eat, things you're supposed to eat a lot of, things you only eat in certain situations. Those rules can become a big part of who you are. And when you become an adult and start your own life, you gotta decide whether you'll keep following all those rules. You may start to wonder what it would mean if you challenge them. Would it change who you are? This is what the story we're sharing today is about. Ayman Ismail is a staff writer at the website Slate, where he often writes about his Muslim identity and what it means to be a practicing Muslim in this country. Ayman grew up in Newark, New Jersey. Both his parents emigrated from Egypt, and he says that when they came to the U.S. to start a family, one thing was a very high priority.
For them, it was really important that they raised us to be good Muslim kids, and they expected that Islam would be our guiding light in this crazy world. And, you know, in a lot of ways it was. I'm thankful for it. But at the same time, it was much easier for them to teach us what we weren't versus what we were. So a lot of my relationship to Islam early on, at least, was very much, okay, you're Muslim, so you don't drink alcohol, and you're not going to have a girlfriend, and you're not going to have sex before you're married, and you're going to just do all these Muslim things, but really how you express and practice your religion is all the things that you don't do.
And Ayman says he learned early on that one of the biggest things you don't do as a Muslim is eat pork.
It occupies this very real space in our minds all the time. You can't just avoid pork. You need to avoid all the pork products. And like, there's things like gelatin that brands will like sneakily just put like pork products into your Pop-Tarts. And so now you can't just go to the store and buy Pop-Tarts. Like, you have to read the ingredients and see where's the sneaky pork is.
And as a kid, growing up Muslim, did you feel tempted by pork?
No. Why would I? I mean, a lot of people tend to make a big deal about Muslims not wanting to eat pork. But like, yo, we got lamb. We got, we got kofta. Right.
There's no shortage of delicious foods.
Yeah, it's like everybody's like, oh, bacon's the best. I'm like, have you had a rack of lamb? Are you going to compare those two? No, you can't. You can't.
Ayman spent his childhood in a pretty insular Muslim community. He went to a Muslim private school where his mom was actually one of the teachers. So he wasn't exactly going to stumble on a plate of bacon at a friend's house. Ayman liked school. He took it seriously. He started studying the Quran. And he came to a realization. There's the rules on paper, and then there's the rules in practice.
One of the things that I discovered when reading the Quran was that there was so much to say about like backbiting and like talking about somebody without them knowing that you're talking about them. God describes it as eating the flesh of your sibling. And that is so widespread in every single community. All we do is talk shit. And that's like something that everybody, that I do, you know, I talk shit. So it's really hard for me to hold something like don't eat pork and don't backbite in the same way, because God talks in the Quran so much more about backbiting than not eating pig. but it's so easy to avoid pig and it's so hard to not to backbite. So you tend to see that people will latch on to certain rules more than others.
In other words, even though the Muslim prohibition on pork is not a huge focus in the Quran, it's a huge deal in daily life with tremendous cultural significance, especially for Muslims in America. When Ayman was 11, he started to understand why. He left his religious school and transferred to a public high school. He was the only Muslim student there, which made him an outsider. And right away, the other kids zeroed in on the fact that he didn't eat pork.
It was definitely a game for them where, you know, there would be like pork on the lunch menu and they would try to like throw it into my food or throw it into my mouth. You know, little kids being little kids. And it was sort of a game for them.
Ayman played along. He says it didn't really upset him. But then, just days after he started in his new school, 9/11 happened. Those attacks affected his family personally.
You know, as a kid who grew up in New Jersey, whose dad worked in New York and was in downtown New York when the towers came down, you know, we thought my dad had died because anybody from this area knows, like, the phones weren't working, the tunnels were all closed. Nobody got home that night. Everybody came home like days later. And so we thought he had died. And it was one of the most horrifying experiences as Americans, but we're Muslim. So other people have embodied that, you know, that horrible terrorist attack, and they sort of leveraged it against people like me who were here. Then Donald Trump says shit like, and people and Muslims in New Jersey were celebrating, and people outside of New Jersey believe that.
Ayman says he didn't feel any hostility in his school after the 9/11 attacks, even when someone wrote in his yearbook, "Thanks for not blowing up the school, terrorist." He took that as a joke. But for Muslims across the country, things were a lot more serious. In the years after 9/11, Muslims experienced a wave of hate crimes, some of which had a common thread.
Calling it desecration, a Muslim civil rights group is demanding a weekend incident in Las Vegas be investigated as a hate crime by federal authorities. Surveillance video shows an unidentified man meticulously putting bacon on the doors of a mosque.
After their morning prayer, members of the Islamic Center of Murfreesboro came out their side door to find spray paint and bacon put on the door and on the ground in what's being called a hate crime.
The mask of a pig head and a sign that targeted Muslims was found at the Islamic Center of Greater Austin and Austin Peace Academy.
That's a real part of America that thinks that will spontaneously combust if we go near it or touch it. Meanwhile, I'll think to myself, what a waste of a pig head. You could have eaten that thing. You know, why are you leaving bacon on the door handles?
Right.
That's food. What are you doing?
After high school, Ayman went to Rutgers University, where he tried to figure out what he wanted to do with his life. He joined a band and played gigs in New York. He worked at the college TV station and as a videographer. After graduating, he got into video editing and then started getting interested in journalism. And there was one person whose work he admired so much that this person became the reason Ayman decided to become a journalist.
I'm Anthony Bourdain.
That's right.
I write, I travel, I eat,
and
I'm hungry for more.
So good. You know, but one of the things that Anthony Bourdain loves is pork. You know, and he'll do a lot of trips to places where they'll just get the big pig on the spit and they'll roast it. And he's just describing this thing like it's heaven. And I believe him. And it just looks delicious the way that they roast the pig, you know. And that was sort of my gateway drug through. And I use that term very real here because it does feel like a gateway drug where it opened me up into all these different kind of travel shows. I really loved David Chang's show on Netflix. I'm going to blank on the name. Oh, Ugly Delicious. Yes.
Yep.
So good. He did an episode about pork where he would go all across the country looking for like the most authentic pork. You can't just cook a rack of ribs and then call it barbecue. And like the pit masters were extremely-
After watching a bunch of these shows without ever actually eating pork, Ayman became a barbecue snob.
Pork is. But you don't really know how serious and emotional this is until you hear a pitmaster talking about why they're picking the juices up from the bottom of the tray with a syringe and injecting it back into the pig while it's cooking. Like something like that, where they're talking about their soul and they're talking about what is authentic American, what isn't. All of that still rings true to me, even though I've never tasted it.
As a kid, Ayman had no interest in trying pork. But once he started binging all these food TV shows, he couldn't help but feel curious to taste it. He began to wonder, are other Muslims curious too? He decided to write a story about it for Slate and began interviewing people, recording the calls for his article.
Hey, Smoggle, man. Sorry, how you doing?
Oh, man, amazing.
This is Ayman talking with Wajahat Ali. He's a columnist for the Daily Beast and the author of a new book called Go Back to Where You Came From and Other Helpful Recommendations on How to Become American. Wajahat has also thought a lot about pork.
There was a cheese pizza at school, and I took off the pepperoni and ate it, which I don't do anymore because I thought it would be fair. But then there was a small sliver of pork that I convinced myself was red sauce attached to the side. And then I ate it, and it was delicious. But it wasn't worth it because for the next 2 weeks, I was like racked by guilt. I was convinced I was going to go to hell.
At the time, Wajahat was just 7.
No matter where you go, I've traveled and, you know, talked to many Muslims. It's just one of those interesting cultural demarcations where you could like be snorting cocaine off a stripper's belly while taking shots of vodka and like engaging in a threesome. But you'd be like, no, bro, I don't do pork. Like, you know, like this is one of those taboos that you realize is like something that we just do not do.
Ayman talked to another Muslim who asked him not to use her real name in his article because she admitted that she once tried bacon. He wasn't writing this story because he planned to try pork. It was really a way for him to analyze and unpack this taboo without breaking it. And then...
I'm here to announce the latest addition to the Impossible family, Impossible Pork! The launch of pork is...
That's Pat Brown, founder and CEO of Impossible Foods, in a promotional video. Impossible Foods is one of the biggest companies making plant-based products that are supposed to look, smell, and taste just like meat. You know, they do the Impossible Burger, which is now in a lot of places. They add the molecule heme to those burgers, which makes it look like the burger is bleeding and gives it a meaty taste. And now they say they're launching vegan ground pork. Pork in air quotes. This means that Ayman would have the chance to experience something very close to ground pork without ever actually eating pig. Now, Impossible Pork wasn't in stores yet. It's still not in stores now. But still, Ayman wanted to answer the question for himself. When he can get his hands on it, should he try it? There's one person he knew he had to talk to, someone who he could turn to for real advice. His former teacher at the Muslim school he attended as a kid, Nadia Ismail, who you'll recall is also his mom. In a phone call, she explained that it's not just about the pork. It's about the importance of observing rules.
We need rules in our life to follow, to guide us, to make us better human beings, to help the people around us.
Ayman's mom understood that technically Impossible Pork has no pork. But for her, it's not just about the letter of the law. It's about the spirit of it.
I was wondering why. It is halal to eat it because it doesn't have any pork in it. But why?
Her thing is, don't eat it. Because if you're eating it, you are entertaining something that could potentially lead you down a path where you try something not good. So she's like, why even roll the dice, even if the chances are slim? Don't I make good enough food for you? Like, that's sort of her take.
Right.
And her take was also, you kids are spoiled. When she first got to this country in the 70s, there wasn't really a halal market anywhere. But now they're like right next to the other meats in any supermarket. There's always like a halal section. So she's like, well, you guys got this and you're still wanting to try pork? Like, what's wrong with you? So there's definitely a struggle there because wanting to eat it feels incredibly hypocritical because not eating it is so ingrained in how you perform Islam, especially in a non-Muslim country. And so avoiding it, it's a little bit what makes you a Muslim here.
Ayman was conflicted about whether or not he would try Impossible Pork when it came out. He put these mixed emotions and the quotes from Wajahat Ali and his mom into his piece. Last September, it was published on Slate with the headline, Impossible Pork is Testing My Faith. The article struck a nerve.
You know, I was given a lot of grief by some Muslims that I know ever since that article came out. I still get emails from angry Muslims being like, you're sending people down the wrong path and that you're making it harder for some people to want to be Muslim now.
But a day after the article came out, Ayman also got a different kind of email from Impossible Foods. They wanted his address.
And they sent me like 5 pounds of it, like something crazy. It was like this huge block of just fake meat. And I stuck it in my freezer and I didn't tell my wife about it. And she came home and she was like, what the hell?
It was one thing to resist temptation when the Impossible pork was theoretical. Now the stuff is in Eamon's freezer. What should he do? Later in the show, we'll check back in with him. But first, another story about the real conflict around fake meat. Because Muslims aren't the only ones who are struggling with Impossible pork. That's coming up. Stick around.
Time to cook up some advertisements.
Norwegian Cruise Line breaks the boundaries of global cruise travel. When you cruise with NCL, you're going to get award-winning specialty restaurants, a variety of food and beverage offerings, immersive entertainment, and the most thrilling experiences at sea. It is first class. These ships have all kinds of specialty restaurants: Brazilian steakhouse, French, Spanish, Italian, Japanese, Mexican. Select ships also feature al fresco dining on the waterfront and Ocean Boulevard, an oceanside promenade lined with bars and restaurants. Norwegian provides guests with truly authentic and fresh dining and bar experiences complemented by exceptional service. Almost everything you'll eat is prepared from scratch by highly experienced chefs. And they got whatever you're going to be in the mood for. You want a quick casual family meal? They've got that. You want a beautiful four-course feast? They've got that too. And you can sip something delicious at one of up to 23 unique bar and lounge options per ship. Visit and explore exciting destinations around the world and enjoy unique experiences on board. With no set dining and entertainment times and no formal dress codes, you have the flexibility to design your ideal vacation. Book your next adventure at ncl.com.
1 in 8. That's how many people have worked at a McDonald's. Who'll serve millions the best Big Mac and best birthday party they've ever had? Who haven't just seen kids graduate from a Happy Meal, but have gotten help graduating themselves? Because they know the skills learned here.
Bienvenidos. Welcome to English Under the Arches.
Can help you grow from here or keep growing here.
Hi,
1 in 8 start at McDonald's. And where you start stays with you.
This episode is brought to you by Merrick Pet Care. We have a dog. Her name is Sasha. She's almost 4. She's a standard poodle. She's black and fluffy and soft and very adorable. And when we first got her, we took her to like this puppy kindergarten training class. The whole family went. And, you know, they're teaching you how to use the treats and all this. The trainer watched Sasha for a bit and said, she's very food motivated. And my daughter Emily turned to me and said, she's a Pashman. And so she is food motivated. And that's why we make a point of feeding Sasha high quality pet food. Founded in Hereford, Texas, Merrick has been crafting high-quality dog food for over 30 years. Real is Merrick's recipe, so they always use deboned meat, fish, or poultry as the number one ingredient. And let me tell you something. When it's dinner time, Sasha is motivated, okay? She is highly motivated to come in from patrolling the backyard at dinner, to get up off the couch, whatever she's doing, she will drop it and come running. Check out Merrick online or in your local pet store and look for their new packaging with real ingredients shown on the bag and inside it. I just got a very wonderful shipment of goodies from the folks at Reese's. And let me tell you something. These people remain the absolute worldwide leaders in bringing together chocolate and peanut butter. Of course, we know the peanut butter cups remain transcendent. But have you tried the Reese's Sticks? They're wafers with peanut butter in between each wafer, all coated in chocolate. I mean, the combination of sweet chocolate and salty peanut butter just brings people joy, and the folks at Reese's do it better than anyone. So shop Reese's Peanut Butter Cups now at a store near you, found wherever candy is sold. Welcome back to The Sporkful. I'm Dan Pashman, and I want to take a quick break from food here because I got something important I want to talk with you about. Recently, a bunch of us in the podcast community have joined together and partnered with Represent Us, a nonpartisan organization that works to protect our elections and pass laws that make our government work better for all Americans. Right now, our right to vote is under threat. 19 states passed laws last year that make it harder for American citizens to vote. Election workers are quitting in droves because of threats and harassment. So I hope you'll go to represent.us/podcast to find out what you can do about it. Now, to be clear, this is not about supporting any candidate or political party. It's about making sure that all Americans, all of us, regardless of our politics, have an equal opportunity to vote and have our voices heard. Now, I can hear some of you already saying it. why is he talking about this in a food podcast? Well, first of all, food is political, and we often address political themes on our show, as we are in this very episode. And second, I'm talking about it because this is a food podcast. Because while I'm sure some of you are super politically engaged, I know that some of you are more focused on what's for dinner. And that's okay. But you're the ones I especially want to reach. There are things we can do together to ensure all Americans have an equal say in our country's future. To learn more about what you can do, please head to represent.us/podcast to learn more. That's represent.us/podcast. Okay, back to the show.
My mom's side is Jewish. My dad's side was not. But my dad was sort of, he called himself a born-again agnostic. Like, he did not care about religion. And my mom wanted us to be a Jewish family. So that's what we were. We weren't like a Christmas tree and menorah family. We were just a menorah family.
This is Leah Koenig. She's a food writer and cookbook author who lives in Brooklyn. She grew up outside Chicago in a family that was Jewish, but as she says, not super observant. On Yom Kippur, the holiest day of the year, when Jews are supposed to fast all day, Leah's family would go to temple in the morning, then go out for corned beef sandwiches for lunch. Her family ate plenty of non-kosher foods at home, like shellfish.
But my mom drew the line at pork. Pork has a much, much higher level of power and guilt associated with it, for sure.
Why do you think that is? Of all the rules in Judaism that your mom could have chosen to hold on to, why do you think that was one of the few?
Pork has a kind of sad history for Jews in that pork has been weaponized against Jews many, many times throughout the centuries. One of the grossest examples is during the Spanish Inquisition, when Jews were basically told in Spain and Portugal that they had to either convert to Catholicism, be killed, or leave. One way that people had to sort of prove that they were no longer Jewish was to eat pork.
And Leah says even before that, back during the Middle Ages in places like Germany and Austria, Jews were depicted as a race that came from pigs.
There are these frescoes or paintings that called Judensau that literally depict Jews suckling at the teat of a mother pig. And it's literally as disgusting and as violent sounding as you are imagining. And some of those paintings still are hanging in churches in Germany.
In 2018, a member of Berlin's Jewish community went to court to try to get one of these images removed from a church. But the court ruled against him, keeping the painting in place.
Was my mom aware of all of these specific things in her, when she was making her decision? Probably not. But there is this kind of inherited trauma around the violence of pork and Jews that I think gives it a much greater hard and fast no than some of the other laws. I always joke that Jews are not breakfast meat people because if you're, anywhere in America, if you go to a diner, if you go to a Denny's, whatever, there's sausage, there's bacon, there's breakfast ham. I don't think I've ever had meat for breakfast in my entire life, unless you count smoked lox, because there's just not really a Jewish breakfast meat in the same way. I never feel more Jewish than when I go to a diner with friends and they're all having sausage and I'm having just the pancakes.
Leah did try pork a couple times as a kid, but she doesn't really remember it. When she was 17, after a lesson on meat production in her high school science class, she gave up meat entirely. Food started becoming a bigger part of her life.
My vegetarian identity was very much a part of who I was. And actually, it also, as I sort of got more interested in the Jewish side of my identity, which happened kind of in college and after college, being a vegetarian was my way of keeping kosher. So for me, vegetarianism kind of took on this spiritual power or resonance.
When Leah got married at 26, she'd been a vegetarian for nearly a decade. Her husband was modern Orthodox Jewish, so he ate meat, but only kosher meat. Over several years, they both changed some of their food rules. He'd go to non-kosher restaurants, and she began eating meat again.
I wanted to eat meat in this way that felt kosher and also sustainable and took into consideration animal ethics and things like that. So pork wasn't really an option because there wasn't kosher pork, and I'm sure there was ethically raised pork, but I needed both.
Today, Leah's turned her love of food into her career. She writes modern Jewish cookbooks and reports on food for places like the New York Times, Savour, and Tablet, an online magazine of Jewish news and culture. One day last year, her editor at Tablet got in touch and said, hey, there's a new product coming out called Impossible Pork. Why don't you look into it? Maybe read an article about it. Leah found that Impossible Pork had become a very polarizing topic in the Jewish community. Now, for more observant Jews, for food to be kosher, it's not enough for it to not have pork or shellfish in it. Even if it has no meat at all in it, the food still has to be certified kosher. One of the main groups that grants this certification is the Orthodox Union. You may have seen their OU seal on a bunch of foods. It's a U inside a circle. Impossible Pork asked the Orthodox Union for the seal, and the union turned them down. But the reason had nothing to do with the ingredients.
When they had given a beef bacon product a couple years ago certification, they got just like inundated with calls of people being like, what is this? Why did you give a bacon product a certification? Can I eat this? What is it, pork? Like, people were very confused. The reason that they didn't give certification to Impossible Pork is because they didn't want to go through that rigmarole again. And they basically were like, we see that there is nothing not kosher in the letter of the law about this product. But from an optics point of view and from the consumer's point of view, we don't want to give people a heart attack seeing like an OU on a product that says pork. And from what I understand, they went to Impossible and basically said, if you change your name to make it more clearly not real pork, we will give it certification. But Impossible Pork, for I'm sure good reasons, decided they didn't want to do that.
So the rabbis said, if you'll change the name to, let's say, Impossible Fake Pork.
Yeah. Or Impossible PYRK, or like, you know, something like that.
Right, right. Or Impossible Soy Pork or something, yeah. Right, that communicates it, then they'd be okay. But simply by calling it Impossible Pork, they felt like that was going to be too confusing for people.
Yes.
What do you think of that?
I mean, I think that kosher certification in general sometimes doesn't give people a lot of credit to be smart, informed consumers. If you're going to put something in your body, if you're going to bring something into your kitchen, you need to at least have enough awareness about what it is that you can like make that decision yourself, right? Like, there's nothing, you can turn around the package and see the ingredients right there, and there's nothing, anything close to a meat product, let alone pork product.
But that wasn't enough to persuade the Orthodox Union. For her article, Leah also talked to an Orthodox rabbi named Shmuley Yanklowitz, who's vegan and runs a Jewish animal advocacy organization.
He is kind of all for products like Impossible Pork that, you know, give people a chance to kind of live happy, kosher lives in whatever way. But for him personally, the thought of eating that product just completely disgusted him. As a vegan, he has no interest in eating sort of like any fake meat product, let alone fake pork. But what I actually noticed when I was talking to people for the article, the general consensus was, I'm down with a veggie burger, but I'm not interested in fake pork.
Why do you think they weren't interested?
I think it goes back to that kind of spiritual like hold that pork has over us. People who've decided not to eat pork have made that decision. And so they're kind of like, they don't want the wiggle room.
Once again, it's a question of the letter of the law versus the spirit of the law. People are saying, yeah, technically it doesn't have pork in it, but you're calling it pork. And the whole idea of it is to make something that looks and smells and tastes as much like pork as possible. This reaction gives Leah mixed feelings.
It can almost lead to this sort of like Olympics of who's like the most pious. There's this sense of like, of course I wouldn't eat it. And, you know, not only would I not eat it, but I like wouldn't even, you know, go into a restaurant that would serve it, or, you know, oh, well, I wouldn't even do, you know, take it one step further.
I wouldn't even say the word pork.
Exactly. Exactly. I would like leave one letter out to make sure I'm not saying it correctly. It's kind of like a double-edged sword. Like, I like it because I think it's cool that there are some people who really take it so seriously, but I also think it can lead to a little bit of an unhealthy relationship to the laws.
Leah put these mixed emotions and the quotes from the Orthodox Union and Rabbi Yanklowitz into her piece. Last October, it was published in Tablet with the headline, "Is it kosher to eat fake pork?" She thought that was the end of it. Just one more story about this new food. But then...
I had linked Amon's Slate piece in my Tablet piece, and I think I wrote him and said, just like, thank you for... your great piece and wanted to connect. And then he reached back out to me and said,
I was like, Leah, look at this stuff. I have it. What are we going to do?
And to be clear, when I was writing the piece, I had zero interest in trying it.
But there must have been a little bit of you that was also just excited to try it.
Honestly, not. I was a...
curious. Maybe excited is wrong. Curious?
Curious, yeah.
So a Muslim and a Jew walk into a kitchen full of fake pork. Leah, Eamon, and I are all on Zoom together, and they explain what happened next. Eamon had this freezer full of impossible pork. He really wanted to try it, but he didn't know what to do with it. He's not much of a cook. Leah was a little bit curious, and she does cook. She's the food writer and cookbook author. Together, they decided to go for it. Eamon invited Leah over. He originally wanted to make kofta, his favorite food that his mom makes. It's ground meat and spices. But Leah struck that down because that's traditionally made with beef or lamb. A pork substitute wouldn't make sense in kofta. She thought they should make something that typically would have pork in it.
And so we ended up doing pot stickers, which neither of us had ever made. I've certainly eaten them plenty of times with chicken and other things. So I said, okay, I know what it tastes like as a dish. What is it going to taste like with this sort of, you know, fake pork flavor going on? And I guess I was a pushy, which I didn't mean to be, but I guess I was, because that's what...
No. You were very convincing. You were convincing, and I think you made your point, and I agreed in the end.
So that's what we ended up making.
So I have no experience in the kitchen, so she sent me a recipe and was like, we need these ingredients, and then that's sort of where my job ended. She was, like, mincing, and she was, like, cutting all the ingredients. I more or less watched. But watching her work in the kitchen was magical, by the way.
Aw. I remember it differently. I think we were co-sous chefs.
Leah worked from a straightforward recipe. Ginger, soy sauce, scallions, and dumpling wrappers. And next to all that was a big block of impossible pork.
That was the moment that was sort of like, you know, the million-dollar moment when we cut into the package and kind of touched the fake pork. And, it, you know, Impossible is kind of known for making things that feel real. And it really did kind of have that kind of squishy texture of ground meat.
Yeah.
So you're wrapping them in dough wrappers, you're getting ready to cook them. Eamon, how are you feeling?
I'm excited. It was all coming to a head for me. I had never imagined that I would ever get this close to eating something that was pork or smelled like pork or tasted like pork. I've smelled it 1,000 times. I grew up in the Ironbound, where there's a huge Portuguese and Brazilian community.
In Newark.
Yeah, in Newark. And so there's a lot of pork in the air. It's just clouds of pork everywhere. And so I'm really familiar with the smell. And for me, when we started cooking it, I was getting a little bit of that same smell. And so I was just getting all giddy on the inside, feeling like this could be the first time in my life that I finally know what I'm missing out on. And a part of me wanted it to taste bad so that I can turn around and be like, that was nasty. There's no reason to ever try that again. Because I told myself over and over again that this was the reason that I was different from all of my neighbors who weren't Muslim.
Leah, tell me, how are you feeling while the pot stickers were cooking before you had eaten any?
Yeah, I mean, I think while we were making them, my hesitation sort of faded and almost in a sort of like, what's the big deal? Like it just is like any other meat. And so to actually be handling it and, you know, squishing it in the bowl with all the other ingredients and wrapping it inside these little, the little wrappers, it demystified it in a way. And so I was actually getting more excited to try it as we were making it.
You know, what's really funny is that my wife was there with us. And once we like opened the packaging, I ran into the other room and I was like, Mita, you should try this. You should try this. This is the pork. This is what we're like talking about. And she was like, no thanks.
Leah, what was your husband's take on all this? When you told him you're going to Newark to hang out with Eamon to eat impossible pork?
He was jealous. He was like, bring me some home.
Leah and Eamon finished cooking the pot stickers and brought them out to Eamon's backyard.
We were just sitting in the sunshine. We had chopsticks and dipping sauce, and it was just very lovely. Like their beautiful son was sitting in a bouncer and being adorable. So like, it was just something that I haven't done in a while because of COVID, like going to somebody's house to share a meal. When I bit into the first one, I think it was sort of two things happening at once. The first was, this tastes really good. I would like another one. They're delicious. Let's keep eating them. And then on the other side, it was just sort of like, what's the big deal? Like, these are pork-ish pot stickers, like what was I so afraid of, or what was I so resistant to, I guess.
Yeah, the first bite was freaking good. And I, like Leah, couldn't stop eating them. They were so fun sized too. Like these like tiny little fun dumplings. They were so cute. So like we just were popping them like crazy. But the first one, I remember expecting it to taste like nothing I've ever tasted before.
Mm-hmm.
And it just tasted like a lot of things I've had before. You know, I needed it to taste like the best thing I've ever had for me to feel like I would ever go out of my way to like test my relationship with Islam in this way ever again. But once you got past the first bite and you end up with like the second and third and fourth, all of that melts away a little bit where it's not so loaded. And then you're just enjoying the meal.
Yeah.
And like Leah said, you're enjoying the weather and we're like talking about something else. And I'm like really excited about my garden and I'm just like clipping everything and force feeding it to Leah.
Yeah, you sent me home with some beautiful chard, which we really enjoyed.
That's what I mean. It was like, once we got past that, it was just sharing a meal with someone lovely.
I have done, you know, a lot of work internally over the last 10 years, trying to figure out where I want to fit in the spectrum of being an environmentally conscious eater, of being a Jewish eater. And so I have come to this place by, you know, being a vegetarian for 10 years, being a vegan for two of those years, trying my first meat after those years in a very conscious setting. It was actually a goat. It was slaughtered according to kosher traditions, and the goat had been raised sustainably. And like, that was like the first meat I had eaten in 10 years. And like, that was a transcendent experience. So I kind of know where I fit at this point and where I want my family and our eating to fit. So this was a really cool experiment, but you know I'm not going to be a pork eater, and I know I don't really want to even make Impossible Pork again. Like it didn't change anything for me in a way that felt like I want to make space for this. And not because I want to block it out, but because it doesn't add anything.
Eamon, on the other hand, says he would eat Impossible Pork again. But there's a bigger reason why he's glad he did it.
It's always been my role in my relationship with the religion to look along the margins and look for the fault lines and get us to talk about them. And particularly when we're thinking about like the Muslim American experience, it's so hard for us to have these kinds of conversations and inquiries, really, outside of the context of Islamophobia and wanting to present ourselves as immovable and here to stay, basically, and solid. People are so convinced that we need to be steadfast against pork as a weapon that was used against our community.
There's almost like a concern that opening up any space for kind of nuance and flexibility might create vulnerability.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not for nothing. Like, people have taken things that I've done, work that I've done, to use it against Muslims. But I do still think that concern cannot outweigh our desire for exploration, our desire for wanting to having hard conversations. Yeah, I've still enjoyed writing and exploring halal pork. And so I'm going to continue to find things like it so that I can push for more awareness, at least amongst Muslims, that it's okay to have a little bit of this doubt. Let's try it and see how we feel.
That was Eamon Ismail and Leah Koenig. You can find Eamon's writing and podcasts on his website, eamon.com. And you can find Leah's writing and cookbooks at leahkoenig.com. We'll put both those links in our show description and website. My thanks to both of them, and special thanks to Eamon's wonderful mother, Mrs. Nadia Ismail. One quick note on Impossible Pork. It's not in stores yet, but it is in one restaurant in America, David Chang's Mama Fuku Sambar in New York. It's also in over 100 restaurants in Hong Kong. Hope you like this episode. Make sure you check out last week's show, in which we answer the question, shallots, I mean, what's the deal? Do they do anything? Are they really just small, fancy onions? Come on. Also, do you need to salt your pasta water? We debate. That episode's up now, where you got this one. This show is produced by me, along with senior producer
Emma Morgenstern,
and producers
Andres O'Hara
and
Johanna Mayer.
Our editor is
Tracy Samuelson.
Additional editing by Fernanda Aguero. The show is mixed by
Jared O'Connell.
Music help from Black Label Music. The Sporkful is a production of Stitcher. Our executive producers are Peter Clowney and Daisy Rosario. Until next time, I'm Dan Pashman.
And I'm Harris Corraloo in Miami, Florida, reminding you to eat more, eat better, and eat more better.
Hey, Keurig coffee drinkers. Did you know that the bold, smooth taste of Dunkin' cold coffee can be brewed in your Keurig coffee maker and enjoyed at home? Dunkin's cold K-Cup pods were crafted to be brewed hot and enjoyed cold. And of course, they're packed with the Dunkin' flavor you crave. Brew over ice and sip in seconds. Because the home with Dunkin' is where you want to be.